I wondered how Libra had returned, seemingly without anyone noticing, or if it had ever launched.
"So, you're close friends with Nicole, but you never met Jared?"
Shauna was saying. "I only know what Nicole's told me about him," I said.
"He passed a few years before I was with Cobb," said Shauna. "They were close. Cobb talks about Jared all the time, their time in the Navy."
"How'd you and Cobb hook up?" I asked her.
"I used to go to this roadhouse, this biker bar out in the sticks," said Shauna. "They did all the MMA pay-per-views out there, and he started chatting me up. He introduced me around to everybody, all the river rats."
We walked the far side of a strawberry bush, past an old outhouse made picturesque by falling into disrepair. We saw Cobb's truck pull through the orchard, returning toward the house.
"We should get back," said Shauna. "We should be there to meet them."
"What is that you mentioned?" I asked her. "You said the river rats?"
"They were in the Navy together. Jared and Cobb and the others," she said.
"Hyald Krugger." "Is that what they call themselves?" I asked. "Are they a gang or something?"
"They called themselves that in Vietnam," said Shauna. "River rats. They patrolled the rivers over there. Talk about it all the time. All the shit they've survived.
Hyald Krugger always says they're the survivors, that lambs are sacrificed, but rats survive." We walked alongside the old barn, spotting wildflowers. There was a hayloft still piled with bales, but Miss Ashley used the barn as a garage. An old Winnebago was parked inside, coated with dust. We rounded toward the house. Jared Betak, Charles Cobb, and the others, Shauna had said. The crew of Libra were the survivors, she'd said. River rats. They aren't the lamb. It's often quipped that the most important personnel in the Naval Space Command are the 24 psychiatrists who work with sailors home from deep waters. Deep space and deep time are irreality, and beliefs built on irreality are beliefs built on quicksand. NSC sailors who have witnessed deep time are often haunted, reacting to events that haven't yet occurred, may never occur. And many sailors who have seen deep space return hollowed, overwhelmed by the immensity of the cosmos. The totality of human endeavor is nothing when set against the stars. We ate dinner together in strained silence, the five of us seated around the kitchen table, the quiet punctuated only by the clink of silverware against china, the sound of our chewing. Chili. The corn Shauna had shucked. Bread. Nicole hadn't spoken since the three of them had returned, more sorrowful than I'd seen her, and I wondered just how deep her mourning for Jared ran, if it was coming back to her or if something might have happened while she was away. I tried to compliment the food, and Miss Ashley and Shauna responded with smiles. But Cobb ate quickly, staring into the screen of his phone, and left the table in a temper. I washed the dishes while Shauna dried, Miss Ashley at the kitchen table having late coffee as the light outside faded. I wasn't sure where Nicole went, or Cobb. I joined Miss Ashley for a cup of coffee, then went outside. Gorgeous here. The house and barn stark against the deepening twilight. I walked around the far side of the house and caught sight of Nicole, leaning against the edge of the open barn door smoking a parliament. Ghostly in her flowing white dress, her peacoat draped over her shoulders.
"There you are,"
she said, her voice velvety between breaths of smoke.
"I'm sorry I haven't been around. I should have been with you today."
"I've been finding my way all right," I said. "Shauna's nice. So is Miss Ashley. How are you holding up?"
"We buried my husband again today," said Nicole.
I came up near her, wishing I was still a smoker, wanting to pass the cigarette between us and enjoy the night. "You don't let on how much you miss him," I said.
"Sometimes I do," said Nicole. "I'll find myself thinking of Jared, and then I'll realize all over again that he's gone, and think of everything that's happened, and the pain hurts new every time."
"After all these years," I said.
"Have you ever lost someone close?"
she asked.
"I have." You forget the bad. Your memory tries to heal the past. Years don't matter either, said Nicole. Time just burns.
Time burns, and you think the wounds are cauterized. But they open up raw again and again.
She looked away from me into the outer darkness. In what must have been a reflection of the last stray light from the sinking sun, her eyes seemed to flare with an olive shine that gave her face a feline complexity. Her expression was expectant, terrified, as if she were keeping watch against unseen predators that might manifest from the night. The sunset was red tonight, the sky a lake of fire. She turned back to me, and the glow in her eyes was gone, a trick of the light that had passed. How was the family? Were they a comfort? I asked. I know you don't get along with some of them.
She could damp rag and watch water run like diamonds.
I don't understand, I said, but she pinned me with her glare. She took a drag on her cigarette. I breathed deeply the taste of her smoke, the sweetness.
You do understand, she said. I know now that you of all people would understand what I mean.
Water without gravity, I thought. Water wriggles away like iridescent worms, or like jellied diamonds. But how could she know? I thought over the afternoon, trying to remember if I had somehow slipped, if I had somehow betrayed myself. But no. She wouldn't know. She couldn't.
I'm growing so old, said Nicole. So fast. I sometimes think I can hear my body aging. I forgot how much I like it out here, how slow the orchard feels. I spend every day helping the elderly, and I see them die. And it seems like waves breaking against the shore. But out here everything is slow. It reminds me of home.
Kenya? She nodded.
Mombasa. They made the trees to look like emeralds. Everything was engineered. Nothing grew naturally. All the irrigation, all the straight lines. You pick a fruit, and the fruit grows right back. There was never any want. I was never hungry as a child. Seeing the perfect rows of fruit trees reminds me of home. I didn't miss it until I realized I'd never see it again.
You can go back, I said. If it's home...
No. My home is gone, said Nicole. My home never was. I went with her because my father met her at a reception in our village. A reception for the crew of Libra. And he made arrangements for me to leave with her.
Libra. The shock of the word. Why are you saying this? Cole...
No more time for lies, she said,
her eyes smoldering with what might have been hatred or cunning.
You're like a message in a bottle to me now. Sometimes the bottle breaks and sinks in the sea, but sometimes the bottle reaches the shore. I can't control which.
Her name hadn't appeared on the crew list, but Nicole knew Libra. She had been aboard Libra. I'd met her and thought she was a barfly, an addict. I thought the surface of her life was all there was. The Donnell House and Mare's Inn, years of drinking and pills and never-ending shifts tending to the elderly. But she had sailed on Libra. Her life was luminous with memories of deep waters.
How do you know? I asked. Who are you?
I had been through medical school, she said. My father convinced her I could help. He wanted a life for me. I loved her the moment I met her. I was inspired by her. I wanted to go with her. She had that quality about her. People wanted to follow where she led. We wanted to follow.
Who?
I asked.
Commander Remark, said Nicole. 47 man crew. Libra was tasked with missions to the galaxies, NGC 5055 and NGC 5194. The Sunflower and the Whirlpool. A 6-year mission.
Nicole lit a new parliament, flicked the smoldering butt of the old cigarette into the grass around the barn. It flared an orange arc, winked out.
We first transitioned to NGC 5194 and observed for 2.5 years. Transitioned to Earthside IFS for shore leave and resupply, she said. But the whirlpool was barren, so Remark ordered us to our second location, the Sunflower Galaxy, and that's where we found the miracle.
What miracle? I asked.
Life, said Nicole. We found life.
QTNs would appear like disease through the future white hole, but throughout NSC's odysseys, the universe had revealed itself as nothing but flaming gas and dead stone. The notion that Libra had discovered a planet supporting life was almost too large to grasp, a great plume swelling within me. The stars above us suddenly swarmed, it seemed, no longer the cold fires of heaven, but pulsing with life like the frenetic masses of organisms contained in a droplet of water.
A planet in liquid, said Nicole. The atmosphere was a methane and carbon mixture. Nothing to support human life, and yet the planet was teeming. It was a small planet circling a binary star. Its surface was an ocean with crystal shapes that swam like leviathans. Crystals like latticework. Mammoth polyhedrons that bobbed and dived in the ink. The crystals sang when they noticed us. You know the sound when you run your finger around the rim of a wine glass? Remark named the planet Esperance, meaning hope. There were landmasses, a crinkle of fjords, and I was on the Exo team. 12 of us. 3 quad landers. We left Libra in orbit and descended through the atmosphere. The binary suns were distant, dying. Winds battered our landers. The air was full of ice. We landed and we made camp.
We all trained on mock alien surfaces, pitching inflatable concrete domes to use as semi-permanent houses, camping in Arizona deserts and Arctic plains of ice, using self-heating burners and smokeless chemical fires. Nights spent in my spacesuit, limited oxygen. I never descended to the surface of a crystal island or an alien sea, but we all trained for such things. Nicole had walked on another world. I imagined her searching out constellations in an unfamiliar sky, like trying to read the braille of foreign tongues.
We had 2 seals, Masolt and Cobb, she said. Jared landed, and so did Beverly Clark, a botanist, and I was assigned as her assistant. Patricia Gonzalez was with us, a geologist, and Nate Quinn, a biologist. Elric, Fleece, and Esco were from engineering, mechanics for the landers. Tamika Ifl, Takahashi, and Josephus Bravati were our pilots. We were nearly 4 billion miles away from the planet's suns. We called them the pilot lights because they were ghostly blue. There were 3 moons, the largest a crater-pocked gargantua that hovered massive wherever we looked, almost like an entire second planet encircled ours. The other moons traced their own arcs, barely visible at times. The smallest circling twice before the largest had even seemed to move. We had difficulty distinguishing day from night because of the frequent eclipses. And even the strongest daylight felt like dusk. The ground was slush and soft like putty. And that slush sucked at our boots and splattered our suits like a fine dust of silica, playing havoc with our electronics. Our communications with Libra were spotty, fragmented static blasts. But the beauty of those ridges, the way the oceans stained the ice blue. After 2 days, we found that the land tapered, began to level off, and we descended shelves of ice and entered into swampland. This was our first physical contact with life, a band of flora like a borderland to the ocean beyond, razors of wild grass, and floppy squirrels with closed bulbs, their stalks more grayish than green. Things with broad leaves, like lily pads, and stringy moss carpeted the icy mud, and clusters of reeds as tall as trees arced above us, grew together like archways, like the entire swamp was one body that had grown in a kind of geometric architecture, It's almost like I thought there was a structure we were inside of, but that I couldn't see, that was invisible. And these plants covered the structure like ivy. Do you understand?
I imagined the Exo team picking their way through the swamp, traversing the flora like tourists passing through a cathedral.
I think so. And we came out to a beach made of pebbles of metal, almost like ball bearings, instead of sand, and the black ocean beyond. Beverly Clark had grown uneasy. She hadn't wanted to land on Esperance to begin with. She had been afraid to cross the swamp, and she panicked at the sight of the ocean. She was hysterical. She told us the ocean wanted to consume us, that she thought the ocean was this planet's mouth. Her fear spread to Quinn and Fleece, and they told us they wouldn't carry the equipment any further. They refused. So there we were, in this abundance of life, and we fell to bickering.
Cobb decided we would sleep in shifts, to get rest before heading back to our base camp and to Libra. In the meantime, the rest of us gathered samples, filling tubes with the ocean, collecting soil samples, rocks, cuttings from the leaves. We tried to force those flower bulbs open, but they were clamped shut. We tried to dig up the larger plants with the root systems intact, but Beverly Clark and Quinn, and even Patricia Gonzalez, fought with us.
They were losing their minds, I said. Overwhelmed.
Not until the moons passed together, said Nicole. The three moons in conjunction. An eclipse. Circles in circles. You could actually feel the change in the gravity they produced together. A lightness. A lift. Being pulled upward by the moons, like a thread in your chest had been tugged. And the oceans responded, receding from the shore, following the moon's pull, a waning tide. The beach elongated as the ocean retreated, and the ocean floor was covered in lichen, a luminescent carpet that grew in the furrows, leading deeper into the ocean. There were glassy rocks in twisting shapes like lava as it curls through water. And farther out still, we saw crystals that dazzled like diamonds. The water receded far enough to expose the body of one of the leviathans. The ringing bodies we had seen from above. Or rather, the crystal shape of the leviathan. It was at a distance, but seemed more like a shape than a body. The same shapes the plants had grown into. Or maybe it was once a body but was crystal now. I don't know how to. I don't have the words. A crystal shape like interlocking diamonds or pyramids inside of pyramids. A fractal. But the most beautiful sight. All the closed buds in the swampland, and the plants along the shore responded to that greater tug of gravity. And all the flowers spread open their leaves, the buds bursting, blossoming in heavy flowers with burgundy organs and long blue petals that glowed. The flowers, blue light, almost hurt to look at. You had to squint.
Your necklace, I said.
A blue leaf. Here, said Nicole, removing her necklace and handing it to me, the pendant of luminescent blue. I received the necklace in cupped hands, just as I had once received a human heart, trembling at the thought of holding an artifact of alien life. I looked closely, saw veins in the blue, a pressed petal still glowing with spectral light.
Oh my God, I said. My God.
But I was uneasy holding it. I returned the necklace to Nicole, who slipped it away into her pocket, the blue light extinguished.
All the flowers opened, said Nicole. In the swampland and all along the shore. So many flowers had grown beneath the ocean. The exposed sand was like a field of blossoming wildflowers. And as we watched, their spores, or their pollen, lifted toward the moons, fuzzy lights like blue and gold rain, but rain in reverse. And that's when it happened to Quinn. When Quinn began to scream. We all stared at him, standing in that field of flowers, the spores lifting around us. The spores had sunk into him. They passed through his spacesuit into his body, like he was absorbing those blue lights. His face, through his mask. His eyes bulged and bled, and I saw his suit pulled from him, his helmet, but they were held in the air beside his body. And he was lifted, naked, several feet off the ground, his arms spread, his legs spread, his skin burning in the alien light. This all happened so quickly, I screamed. I thought I was screaming. His neck opened along a seam, and blood sprayed from him, filling the air with mist. And other seams opened along his arms, along his thighs, and blood rushed from him for several minutes. His body shriveled, but the droplets hung suspended like a fog around him. His skin peeled away. The skin of his hands came off like gloves, the skin of his arms like sleeves, his chest like a long coat. The skin floating like scarves caught in the wind. He was floating, a floating body, clouds of meat, white tendons, and a shape opened in his chest, opened in him like an eye, a polygon, its points connected, and I could see through that shape into another place, as though a portal had opened in him, another ice landscape, and another, and another. I looked through him, but I felt something look back into me. I felt as if something had reached through him and I had been touched. His body was sectioned apart, his skeleton separated, and soon he was only an outline tracing of nerves and veins, like a man made of lace. Each of his organs lined up in the air and formed a cube around him. Everything was displayed. Nicole moaned like a dog dreaming, and her eyes rolled to the night sky. I felt faint, thinking of the silence of the universe and the sounds of crystal bodies ringing. Nicole had seen a body opened in midair, like a cadaver opened on a table. The thrum of the circulatory system, the nervous system, ringing, the wet bellows of the lungs. I was filled with fear. Bodies stripped of skin, muscles hanging displayed in the air. Zygomaticus major, depressor anguli oris, orbicularis oculi, orbicularis oris, an autopsy. Beverly Clark was next. She ran and crawled, but was lifted into the air and dismantled. She was a fractal, all her pieces. Her blood was a mist we ran through, and we had lost our minds. I was burning inside, like my brain and my eyes were fire, like my skin would burn from me. And Takash, she screamed, and I saw him fall on Patricia Gonzalez and beat her to death, break apart her face mask and beat her as she choked on the air. And I couldn't endure the burning any more. I wanted to die, anything to end the pain. I wanted to run into the black ocean to drown. But Jared, my Jared was screaming, burning, and he tried to kill me. He had changed, I said. That place drove him mad, turned him murderous. Only Corbin Masolt was sane, said Nicole. They saved us, the SEALs. They were able to keep their minds. Maybe because of their training, Cobb was able to pull Jared from me. He got through to him somehow, and Patrick lifted me from the ground, and I heard his voice like through water. But eventually his words came to me. Run. Run. We left Takahashi, and I saw Esko run into the ocean, disappear into the ocean. Fleece had snapped, but he came with us. Cobb carried him. We lost Tamika Ifel at base camp, but the rest of us launched in the Quadlanders. We peeled off our clothes, scratching at ourselves. Our bodies were burning. We docked with Libra, and Remark retreated far from the planet. We heard the crystalline ringing, and the space around us turned brittle, like ice, shimmering like diamond dust. Remark launched the BL drive before all the space around us had gone brittle, and we transitioned. But it followed. "What followed you?" I asked. "That white light. It traveled the negative energy the BL drive left in our wake. The negative energy sailors call Casimir lines." Remark transitioned again and again. But the white light was always above us, always surrounding us. And we were running low on food.
"And so you left for Earth," I said, realizing that Nicole was describing the birth of the Terminus.
"A far future," said Nicole. "We jumped to the far future. Thousands of years, hoping a civilization with technology greater than our own would be able to help us. But when we came through, the white light had appeared, that second sun. We saw the future of mankind dissolve. We saw men running to the seas to drown, and saw men hanging in the air. We saw men, their mouths filled with silver. Remark transitioned into other futures, but the white light shone above every sky, fouling every possibility."
I thought of something like wildfire scorching the skies of infinite Earths. I thought of the white hole shining like a dead eye.
"Remark knew," said Nicole. "She gathered us together in the enlisted men's mess hall, the only place large enough to gather as an entire crew. She talked to us about Everett Space, about how we were travelers in futures called Everett Spaces that were carved from our observations, our experience. She told us that if we committed suicide, all of us, that if we all killed ourselves, then everything we had seen, everything we had discovered would blink out. We could jump to a new future and commit mass suicide, and everything that we had seen and experienced aboard Libra would cease to exist. Terra Firma would never know about Esperance. The planet would go unfound, because if we blinked, then it would be like we'd never found it. We could save humanity." She told us she would start the sequence to create a cascade failure in the BL drive, that the destruction of the engine would obliterate us and everything we had uncovered. She said it would be painless.
"But you refused," I said.
"Hild Krugger didn't want to die," said Nicole.
Remark at her supporters. Chloe Krauss. She was our WEPS. And there were others.
But there were more people who were ready to listen to Hild Krugger, who joined with him when Remark ordered us to kill ourselves. He gathered people around him.
"Mutiny," I said.
"I'm innocent. I'm innocent in all this. Everything that happened, everything that will happen. I hid from the fighting in the life support room, and when I heard the fighting come near me, I hid in the brig, where I knew I could lock myself away. Don't you remember? We met once, years ago."
"What?" I asked, confused. "No, that's not possible. How could I remember?"
"We don't have time for your lies, Courtney,"
she said, and took a long drag on her cigarette.
"We need to leave here. You need to get your things."
"Tell me what happened to Remark."
"They killed the crew loyal to Remark," said Nicole. "They captured her. They cut Remark's throat in front of everyone. They were cheering at her death. They killed her. Hild Krugger killed her. They passed the body around, everyone involved in the mutiny despoiling her. They spared me because I was Jared's wife. They killed everyone else. But they spared me. I'm innocent."
"What happened to the ship?" I asked. "You came back here. You brought the Terminus with you. What happened to Libra?" Nicole's eyes welled with emotion. A memory fluttered over her face, gone in an instant.
She reached for my hand, squeezed it. She said,
I know a story. Of ghosts in the forest who precede the living, like spirits born before their bodies. The spirits live life, and then their bodies live the same life, but always a few steps behind.
A flashlight winked in the distance, a sweep of light out near the orchard. Someone searching. Nicole said,
We should leave. Wait here until I come for you.
She retreated into the night, her white clothes like a radiant spill of moonlight before she was swallowed by the dark.
Nicole, wait!
I said.
Nicole!
Her cigarette smoke hung in the air. They killed her, she had said, and my heart quickened. A damp rag, water like diamonds. I was alone here, I realized. Twilight had deepened. The house lights were the only lights except for the red rim of the horizon. Miss Ashley was baking, it smelled like. The air was scented with apples, spices. Chillier now, without my jacket. I shivered, thinking of spores like rain, of autopsies in the air. I thought of Libra. Mutiny. The glare of the flashlight swept closer, swept the lawn, the grass nearer the barn.
Who is it?
I asked.
Quiet.
Shauna's voice. She killed the flashlight.
Wait,
she said.
What's going on?
I asked, but she didn't answer until she had come close enough to whisper.
They're going to kill you tonight,
said Shauna.
You have to leave.
Who is? What are you talking about?
But I felt adrenaline pump through me. My teeth chattered.
Don't go back to the house. Run in this direction,
said Shauna, turning me toward the orchard. She flashed her light once, pointed ahead of us, at the ground.
Go straight through the row of fruit trees and you'll hit the road, right where we walked earlier today. Head away from the house and get to the road.
Tell me what's going on,
Shannon Moss, said Shauna. NCIS.
The shock at hearing my real name, my cover wiped away. I thought of Shauna's face, her dark eyes. But no, there was no recognition.
How would she know?
I don't...
They ID'd you, said Shauna. When Cobb and Nicole left this afternoon, they must have met up with Heilkrugger. They have names of agents who've investigated them, stretching years back. Cobb checked. They ID'd the name Courtney Gim, but I know who you really are. You have to go. I'll have transportation once you hit the road.
Are they Libra?
I asked. Who else is involved?
I don't know what Libra is, said Shauna. I don't know what angle you're working. I'm working domestic terrorism.
Who are you?
FBI, she said.
Go!
The hovering thought that I might die here beat like wings around my skull. When Shauna turned toward the house, I ran for the orchard. I tried to control my breathing like I'd been trained, tried to keep my wits despite my fear, tried to think. Cold sweat damp on my forehead, my back. I had crossed in front of the house, through the spill of light on the lawn, and had made it down the rise into the longer grass when I heard a scream. I lost my footing and fell, looked back toward the house. The gabled house and gabled barn crested the rise, silhouetted black against the hellfire red sunset glow of the horizon. The screaming continued, the piercing shriek of utter shock, of death.
Run. Get up, Shannon. Run.
Down the rise quickly, I gained the orchard, followed the straight rows, careful of my footing. Above me, the trees were vaulted shadows, the sky an outpouring of starlight. The ground around me seemed aglow, moonlight reflecting on the carpet of petals. I hurried, but I heard deep breathing somewhere behind me. Heavy footfalls and breaking branches, someone crashing downhill. A dark shape swept toward me. A man, tackling me to the ground. Wind rushed from my lungs beneath his weight. I couldn't breathe. The man punched wildly, struck my shoulder, my forehead, but glancing blows. Cobb. His hands were crushing weights. If he caught me square, he would knock me out, I knew. But the darkness worked in my favor. I scuttled from him, and when he fell on me again, he didn't land with his full weight, didn't pin my arms. He swung, his fist a brick colliding with my eye socket, flashes of light. Dazed, I clutched at his chest, hugging him, pressing my head to his armpit, held close to minimize his swings as much as possible. He struck my back. I readjusted my grip and my hands found his belt, found the sheath clipped to his belt, the handle of a knife. He pounded my back, kidney punches I felt deep in my trunk. But I was quick with the knife in the moment he relented to find a better position against me. I slid the knife from its sheath and plunged the blade through his shirt into his soft belly. He winced, and I stabbed into his armpit, heard him grunt, felt the strength leave his arm. He let go of me, but I stayed close, slashed higher, dragged the blade across his neck. Hot blood sprayed over me, squirting my face in gushes. Cobb gurgled, belched. He stumbled, toppled. His eyes groped uncomprehendingly at the fruit trees for only a few moments. What had Shauna said? Transportation? FBI? The trees ended and I stumbled into the road. Distant headlights. The car rushed toward me, stopped several yards away. I was pinned in its headlights, dripping with Cobb's blood. A woman stepped from the passenger side, a petite blonde with wide blue eyes, a porcelain doll in jeans and a windbreaker. She pulled her firearm. Drop the knife! Do it! I let the knife fall to the ground. Where's Vivian? She said. I don't know. I don't know, Vivian, I said. A woman named Shauna. Let's go, said the woman. She ushered me into the back of the SUV. A man drove, his hair cropped short as a chestnut burr. He gunned the engine. The orchard was far behind us when the woman asked. Do you need a hospital? I caught sight of myself in the rearview mirror, doused in blood. It's not mine, I said. I'm hurt, but no, not a hospital. My left eye, the one Cobb had struck, pounded with my heartbeat. I realized I could see with only one eye. I just need to clean up. We'll stop somewhere, said the woman. Who are you? I asked. Special Agent Zwerger, she said, holding out her credentials. FBI. Egan, said the driver. Call your supervisor, I said, spitting blood all over their seats. I must have bitten my tongue in the fight. Tell them you have Gray Dove. Shit. My eye. What's wrong with my eye? It's swollen shut, said Zwerger. We'll get someone to look you over once we're safe. We would never be safe. We were bodies in hell, and the white hole was our dead son. I wept, exhausted. Fresh blood filled my mouth and I swallowed. Cobb's blood turned cold on my skin. Sometime later, Egan pulled into a CVS, where Zwerger bought bandages and Neosporin. She sat with me in the back seat while Egan paced outside, arguing with someone on his cell. Zwerger washed my cuts with alcohol wipes, cleaned my face. Gentle. Motherly. A whiff of baby powder and lipstick when she leaned close. I winced when I caught the reflection of myself in the rearview mirror, the overhead light on. My closed eye was deformed from swelling. Yellowed. Purple. She covered my eye with a wide bandage. There, she said. Where are we going? I asked once Egan pulled back onto the road. We'd been driving well over an hour. We'd crossed out of West Virginia into Pennsylvania.
You are an FBI, he said.
NCIS. What are you investigating? Persons of suspicion relating to domestic terrorism charges, said Zwerger. I'm guessing you have a similar interest. Vivian might have blown her cover to get you out of there. We lost contact with her. Whose scream had I heard at the house before I ran? Cobb surprising Shauna? Vivian? Murdering her? I closed off the thought. The windows were tinted, but I caught illuminated signs and placed myself. Connellsville, Uniontown, National Pike, Business 40, the landscape mostly hills with trees and scrub, occasional little strip malls.
Some of those people have militia ties, said Egan. What's your interest?
Domestic terrorism, I said. Zwerger kept quiet, looked out the window. I saw the reflection of her face, an awkward expression, like she was about to sit through a marital feud.
I talked with my supervisor, said Egan. We'll sort this out.
Egan turned into the parking lot of the Blue Mountain Motel, just a dozen or so units huddled beneath a low-slung roof. The entire lot lit only with the neon vacancy sign and a vibrant red Coke vending machine that hummed between the middle units. Only one other car in the lot, a silver sedan parked near the office, an old car. The sedan's interior light was on, a soft shine. Someone was inside, but as Egan pulled through the lot, the sedan's light went dark. "There's nothing for us to sort out," I said. "Tell them you have Grey Dove. The rest is between the NCIS director and your director."
"What's the name of the NCIS director?"
asked Egan, parking in front of Unit 3. I couldn't answer him. He knew I didn't know the answer. Egan stepped from the car, stretched.
"Give me a sec," he said.
Near the light of the vending machine, again on his cell. This was a shorter call, and when he finished, he unlocked Unit 3, stepped inside. A moment later, the room lights glowed behind the heavy curtains. Something isn't right. Egan must have called his superior, must have mentioned Grey Dove, and either didn't believe I was NCIS, or the FBI knew exactly who I was. Egan and Zwerger might take me into that room, ask a few questions, then let me walk, or they might never let me go. Even if Egan and Zwerger didn't know what I was, their superiors might. Their superiors might have flagged Grey Dove and ordered them to interrogate me here, apprehend me. There are prisons in America far from the public view. No charges, no trial. A butterfly in a bell jar. They could hold me here so their existence wouldn't blink. I tried the car door, but it was locked. The interior handles disabled.
"Don't do this," I said to Zwerger.
"You don't understand what you're doing."
"You'll be all right," she said.
"The whole fucking world will die if I don't get out of here," I said. "Call Apollo Sucheckfield. Speak with Special Agent Wally Njoku."
"We're just going to have a conversation," said Zwerger. "Sort everything out. Calm down, otherwise we'll be forced to restrain you."
Kill her, I thought. Kill her and take the car.
But Zwerger stepped outside, opened my door. Weighing options. I might be able to outrun her. Even with my leg, I might outrun her. But there was nowhere to run. I followed her from the SUV. I could scream. There was someone sitting in the silver sedan, and maybe he would call the police if I screamed. Zwerger clutched me by the upper arm. She walked me toward Unit 3, gripped me like I was her prisoner.
"You don't have to do this," I said. "Let me go. Everything you love will die if you don't let me go. A hole will open. A white hole will open and everything will die."
"Enough," she said. The driver's side door of the sedan popped open. The driver stepped out. An older man. A raincoat over a gray suit. A black man with a head of woolly hair.
"Help me!" I called to him. "You've got to call the police, help me!"
"What does this prove?"
he said, taking hesitant steps toward us, his hand on the car, steadying himself.
"Egan, come out here,"
said Zwerger, seeing the man.
"Police business," she said to him. "Do not approach."
Something familiar in the way the man moved. Then I recognized him as he came closer. Brock. His build, thinner than it once was, the bulk of his muscle gone soft. He no longer needed to steady himself, moving swiftly as Egan came out from Unit 3.
"Brock,"
said Egan.
"Why are you here?"
Brock reached beneath his coat, pulled his sidearm from the belt holster. He raised the gun and took a step closer to Egan. Egan lifted his hand, saying,
"Billy!"
Brock fired. Egan crumpled, clutching his belly. A glottal moan, he doubled over on the curb. Zwerger reached for her weapon, but Brock had already swung toward her and fired, clipping her neck. The woman fell, yelping, sputtering for breath. She reached to hold her throat with both hands, but blood pulsed between her fingers, her mouth round with agony. Egan crawled toward the lights of Unit 3, draining out from his gut. Brock put the barrel to Egan's head. Fired. Egan dropped. I looked to Zwerger, but the light had left her eyes. I reached for her gun, but Brock had returned to me, his gun raised to my chest.
Brock, I said. Please. He looked like he was possessed, like his mind had betrayed him. His face twisted into a rictus. He laughed, the sound like barking.
What did I do? He said. Jesus. Jesus Christ, what did I do?
He looked over at Egan's body, said.
Get up. Come on, Egan. Say something. You're all right. Jesus, what did I do?
He holstered his weapon, stood over Zwerger. He said.
She had a child.
He seemed to remember I was there, and he asked me.
What did I do?
We're okay, Brock, I said, trying to pacify him. Everything will be okay. He grabbed my chin, angled my face toward the light of the vending machine, studying me.
What do you prove?
He said. He stared hard into my eyes. He would have crawled inside me if he could have. Something spooked him, some sound I hadn't heard. He flinched, pulled me with him across the lot to his car. Brock pushed me into the passenger seat, hurried to the driver's side.
We have to get out of here,
Brock said, reversing from the lot onto National Pike.
I know who you are,
he said, gunning the car to 60, to 80.
They'll be after us soon. I should have put their bodies in the room. I wasn't thinking. I can't think. I should have moved them. I can't think straight.
I don't know who you think I am, I said. But this...
Don't you fucking lie to me,
he said, drawing his gun, pressing the barrel into my cheek. I leaned away, ear against the window.
I could kill you now. And if I killed you,
he said,
this would all go away, wouldn't it? This would all just disappear, right? Egan and his partner, it would be like I'd never killed them, right? Right? Talk to me!
Please, lower your weapon, I said. Pull over and we'll talk.
Talk now,
he said.
Talk right fucking now!
The road swam before us, headlights on black tar. The gun barrel caused pain, digging into the side of my head. I don't want to die like this, I said.
Can you change what's happened?
He asked.
Is that why you're here? To change all this?
What do you think I can change? I asked. Please, lower your weapon. Please.
Sejus,
he said.
When they attacked Sejus, I lost Rashonda. My girls. Shannon, I lost both of my beautiful girls. Oh, my girls.
Pull over and we'll talk, I said. Please, lower your weapon and pull over. He lowered the gun. His hands shook. He holstered the weapon. I stayed against the window, vision blurred with tears. His entire family would have been laid out in the surrounding fields, in white sheets. They would have breathed sarin and died instantly. I imagined the body of his wife. I imagined the Sejus daycare full of dead children.
The people who killed them thought they were fighting against the end of the world, said Brock. That's why my wife and girls were killed.
He heaved with sobs.
Why did they have to die? And here you are, all these years later. You haven't aged.
I'm so sorry, I said. I'm so sorry about the pain you're in.
You're here to study Sejus, said Brock. To save all those lives.
Patrick Mersault. His name would seem insignificant. One life next to 1,000. What could I tell Brock? I could tell him about Libra. Could tell him about the Terminus. I could tell him that the Terminus cuts across every future, killing everyone who is alive, killing everyone who might ever be alive, killing every possibility in every possible world. I can save your family. I want to save them. I want to save Rashonda, I said. We can talk. Brock found a Sheetz gas station on Route 51, outside Belle Vernon, a 24-hour convenience store. We wiped off as much blood from ourselves as we could with handy wipes he had in his glove compartment. Even so, I wore Brock's raincoat, cinched over my blood-soaked dress. I looked like a horror show. The self-serve restaurant was empty at this hour.
The clerks were teenage girls, a blonde and brunette paging through a hustler, laughing, listening to the radio up near the registers. I cleaned myself in the bathroom, picking out dried blood from my hair, washing my hands and face with foam soap from the dispenser. Brock waited in one of the restaurant booths out of sight from the registers. I joined him. He had diminished with age, with grief. Deep creases furrowed his eyes and mouth. His hair was like cigarette ash.
"I was told to imagine a wall made out of doors," said Brock. "I was told that if I was falling through space toward a wall made of doors, I would fall through one of the doors. Whatever door I fell through would take me into the future. Different doors are different futures, different versions of the future."
"Who told you that?" I asked.
"After Sieges, after the funerals,"
he said.
"You came into my mind. Nestor and I used to talk about you. You'd worked at Sieges. I wondered if you had died that day with my family. The way you'd vanished, I thought you might have died. And I'd think about deep space, and I'd think about Patrick Mersault. And then I caught something on the news. I saw something on 60 Minutes when Naval Space Command was absorbed into a different agency. Mothballed projects. Things that wouldn't mean a damn to anyone who wasn't looking. Goofy things. Chinese satellites. Lasers on the moon. But I wanted to know more. And I asked questions. I couldn't let go. And one morning I had a message from the director. Sealed. Telling me about a restaurant in Silver Spring, Maryland. Called TJ's. Says I'm expected there. The Bureau had the noose around a physicist who used to work at the Naval Research Lab. We had evidence he accepted classified information from the Senate Armed Services Committee. He used classified military secrets to start a company. Phasal Systems. Medical tech. The cure for fucking cancer. All gained from top secret intelligence. We leveraged him, and he spilled. That's how we learned about deep waters. I was brought into the fold. I had lunch with him. This old man who introduced himself by saying he was still like a child, that he should only be 42 in the summer. But he was old, Shannon. He showed me his birth certificate, an early driver's license. He was working at Phasal Systems on the cancer cure. But he knew everything about NSC. He talked about quantum foam and wormholes, and when I wasn't understanding, he told me to imagine a wall made of doors.
"Think of it like a whisk," I said.
"Think of what?"
I slid from the booth, poked around behind the food counter, rummaging through kitchen drawers. Spoons, saran wrap, old rags. I found a whisk hanging on a pegboard near the utility sink. "A whisk," I said, returning to our table. "This is how my instructor taught me." I held the whisk sideways, pointed to the tip of the handle. "Beginning of time," I said. I ran my finger along the handle. "All of history, the observed past." At the top of the handle, I said, "The present."
"And then you hit the wall of doors,"
he said. I touched each of the wires of the whisk. "Possible futures, possible timelines, infinitely possible," I said. "Imagine this whisk with an infinite number of wires."
"What's up here?"
Brock asked, pointing to the tip of the whisk, where all the wires bent, looped toward one another, joined. "Terminus," I said.
"What's that?"
"The end of the world."
"All right,"
he said, cupping his hands in front of his mouth. Vitality had returned to him, a frantic energy. His eyes seemed to be gulping at ideas like a drowning man would gulp at air.
"And where is this?"
he asked, pointing to the end of the handle, the present. "March 1997, I told him. Brock's face cracked into a manic, open-mouthed grin, his eyes frenzied, a glee that terrified me.
"And you traveled here. You flew here. You're an astronaut, aren't you? Like Mersault was an astronaut. I remember asking if he was an astronaut and you didn't blink. You didn't blink because you're like him, aren't you? You time-traveled here."
"I don't know if I'm here or still there,
technically. It's called superposition entanglement. But I was never great at math, I said. You used to chew licorice gum in 1997. He laughed, a sound more like a cry.
I gave it up, he said. Licorice. That gum was from Italy. I used to buy it from the import store, by the box. The only licorice strong enough. Turned your spit black, your teeth and tongue black. But that day, Sejus, I was frantic, because I knew they were dead. My family. I just somehow knew my family was dead, that they were all dead. And I got through the security and ran through the rows of bodies, lifting white sheets off people's faces, each time thinking I'd see one of my girls. But I only saw the faces of strangers. Dead faces. I never saw my girls. Never found them. I was eating my licorice that whole time. A nervous habit. But the next morning I ate a piece of that gum and the smell of licorice filled my mind with all those dead faces. I spit it out.
You're still looking for your girls, I said. You think I'll be able to help you find them?
Why now?
He asked.
Why did you come now?
I don't control it, I said. There are shapes that appear in nature. The shapes of seashells. The spiral shapes of some galaxies. Snowflakes. The swirl pattern of seeds on a sunflower's face. On and on. You see the same pattern repeated everywhere. Leaf fronds, the way a toilet flushes.
Fractals,
said Brock.
The same pattern, repeated forever.
Quantum foam grows like that, too, I said. It's shaped like that. There is a set of numbers that makes those shapes, called Fibonacci numbers. That shape is everywhere in nature. I don't have to travel this far, or I can travel much farther. But the protocol for most investigations is that we travel about 19 years, 6,765 days. I came with the hope that the truth would reveal itself in time. I came to investigate the death of Patrick Mersault and the murder of his family.
Why? Why him? What's his life worth?
Brock asked, but he didn't want to hear my answers about Libra or the Terminus. He was burrowed deep within himself. After a moment, he said,
So this physicist said he enjoyed my company, enjoyed talking with someone who wanted to believe him, and said he wanted ice cream after lunch. There's a Baskin-Robbins right next door to TJ's, so I took him over. We ate ice cream cones together. All theoretical, he told me. He was bullshitting me, maybe, but as we were leaving, he said that if I ever met a traveler, I should capture him, put him in handcuffs, lock him away in solitary. Supermax. Lock him away without a key and keep him alive for as long as possible. Alive and comfortable. Because the moment he dies or goes back through that wall of doors, back to the real present. The true present. Everything I know about life. Every memory I have. Everything. Every person I'd ever known. Every atom in existence. Will disappear.
Blink out, I said.
Gone,
said Brock. We call that the butterfly in the bell jar, I said. It's happened to people like me, being held captive in these futures by people who can't face the awareness of their non-existence.
But what would happen if I came back with you? Could you bring me back?
I could, I said, knowing the case history, the quasi-legal status of individuals NSC ships brought home from futures, the strange lives of these doppelgangers, people we called echoes.
I could see her again, said Brock. My girls. I could hold them. Couldn't I?
You'd only bring confusion and pain, I said. You'd only scare your girls. They'd see you as you are now, as an old man who bears a strong resemblance to their father. Your wife will joke that William Brock, her husband, might look like you when he's an old man. If you tried to go home, you would be a double, nothing more. They wouldn't want you. You'd be an echo of William Brock. You wouldn't be William Brock. Ask yourself, how much do you love them? Do you truly love Rashonda, your wife?
She already has her husband.